And I remember talking to someone who had a website that basically tracked online progressives. So, you know, all the different online casinos, they had slot progressives, video poker progressives, and he had a site that tracked them and then told you when they turned positive, because they were turning positive. And, you know, very useful site to anyone who wanted to grind out that edge. And he's like, the next day, he's like, well, there goes $500,000 because nobody needs my site anymore. No one's going to track these progressives. You know, this was an easy $500,000 a year for my company, and it's gone.
Welcome once again to Low Rollers, the weekly gambling industry podcast that believes in risking a little to win a lot, but instead excels at losing a lot, a little at a time. I'm Eric Raskin, senior editor of Casino Reports. I thank you for listening. Have a great interview for you this week. Unabated.com's Captain Jack Andrews will be joining me, mostly to talk about a very specific topic, the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act of 2006, which recently celebrated a birthday. We'll talk about its immediate impact at the time and its lasting impact, including all sorts of unintended impacts. So you'll want to hear what Captain Jack has to say about all that. But first, my quick thoughts on some news. As I record this Thursday morning, there's a press conference coming up. It will have happened by the time you hear this. FBI Director Kash Patel will be speaking on the gambling-related arrests of Terry Rozier and Chauncey Billups, a couple of nice high-profile distractions from other things happening in the country. I don't know enough details at this moment to say anything more about any of this. I'll just direct you to ingame.com and casinoreports.com for all the latest coverage of both stories throughout the day. And maybe this will be a topic to focus on next week's podcast. In the meantime, another topic I know more about and feel capable of commenting on at the present moment. Toward the end of last week, I got a press release in my various inboxes touting a survey that found 71% of voters in Maryland do not want legalized online casino gaming. My spidey senses immediately tingled because that number, 71%, was well outside the range I'd seen and heard. In most states, these things run fairly close, you know, 55, 45, or closer. And maybe more people in Maryland don't want this than do want this. That wouldn't surprise me if true, but 71 to 29? It seemed like a hard number to believe coming out of an impartial survey. Except this wasn't an impartial survey, and that was obvious the moment I looked beyond the top line of the press release. This survey was commissioned by the NAAIG, the National Association Against iGaming, and it may as well have been a survey of 650 Cordish Companies employees, not 650 Maryland voters. I reached out to John Pappas, former guest here on this podcast, one of the most knowledgeable people at the intersection of DC politics and gambling. And he introduced me to the term push-poll, which is exactly what it sounds like, a poll that pushes respondents in a particular direction and pushes an agenda. In the case of this poll, the details of the press release and the survey analysis all acknowledged that about half of the voters reached admitted to not being familiar with what online casino is, so the pollsters defined it for them, and that definition focused on its risks and downsides and made no mention of the fact that online casino is already available unregulated, that the regulated sites use age verification, etc. A poll has to be neutral in the way it asks a question and the way it defines its terms, otherwise the results are polluted. You know, if I call you up to poll you on Trump's job approval, I have to ask, yes or no, do you approve of the job Trump is doing as president? Not, oh man, authoritarianism is here, the economy's in the toilet, we are circling the drain. So what do you think of the job Trump's doing? That's not a way to get meaningful poll results. So the point is, the minute you see that a poll weighing pro and con for online casino is commissioned by a group whose name contains the words against iGaming, you should be skeptical of that poll. And when they actually admit that they asked leading questions, or at least gave leading definitions, you should throw out the results of that poll. And that's why it really bothered me to see some media outlets playing along, publishing stories headlined, "Survey says 71% of people in Maryland don't want online gaming." This press release was propaganda, and unfortunately, propaganda works, especially if the media fails to call it out as propaganda. Again, I'm not saying a fair poll wouldn't show that a majority of people in Maryland would vote against legalizing online casino. Maybe they would. Maybe they wouldn't. But I do know the Chick-fil-A cows telling you to eat more chicken are not representative of how the entire animal kingdom feels. All right, let's get to the interview talking UIGEA. So enjoy a few seconds of music. And when I come back, I'll be joined by the one, the only, the man who will get you high tonight and take you to your special island, Captain Jack Andrews. The only thing weirder than making a point of celebrating the 19th anniversary of something is celebrating the 19th anniversary 1 week late. Nevertheless, undaunted, I welcome a guest this week to look back on the UIGEA 1 week after it turned 19 years old. He is a professional gambler, one of the founders of Unabated.com, and the first guest in Low Rollers history, and now the first two-time guest as well, Captain Jack Andrews. Jack, welcome back to Low Rollers on this most momentous of anniversary occasions.
Yes, we gather here every 19 years to lament. No, Eric, thank you for having me back on. I feel like I'm only talking to half the room, but
that's yeah. Okay. Yeah, you were the first to voice opposition, disappointment, etc. when Low Rollers became a solo pod, but you know, you could look at it as now you're getting more podcasts with the podcast host you enjoy. They just aren't together anymore.
Right. I'm the child of divorce, and Jeff has already asked me to come on his podcast, and I said, no, sorry, Dad, I got to go do other dad's right. podcast this weekend.
And am I Paul Reiser or am I Greg Evigan if we're going to turn this into a pop culture reference point?
I could have only named Paul Reiser, so that's pretty impressive. And Dick Butkus was in that show, right?
What yes, you're right. He like ran the diner, I believe. Yeah. Good call.
Okay. Well, now that we've turned it back to something I'm familiar with, UIGEA.
Right. Yes, let's talk that. And regardless of the exact timing of our discussing it, it is a fascinating piece of legislation to talk about. As you tweeted last week, drawing my attention to this anniversary, the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act was attached at the last minute to a must-pass sports security bill. Many folks in Congress later said they didn't even realize they voted for it. It totally shook up the world of online gambling. Before we get into its various lasting impacts, I'm curious where you were as a gambler at the time. What were you doing? How much of what you were doing was online? How did this immediately impact you?
Everything I was doing was online gambling at that point. A lot of people remember what the halcyon days were of 2018. You know, we had the gold rush of sportsbook bonuses and promotions and online casinos. That was nothing compared to what it was back 2000, 2001. Look, I tell the story of there was one casino that put out a promotion where they paid double on roulette on the number 7 and the number 00. They paid 70-1 instead of 35-1. And that's a 91% edge to the player. 91%. Millions. Wow. Millions and millions and millions were made by players that day, and it was only available for a couple hours. And they paid because that's how big this industry was back then. You know, people don't understand, like, yes, it was all shady. I was getting checks from foreign countries. My bank closed down my account multiple times because of all of this weird foreign check things that were flowing into my account. Mind you, this is right after 9/11 type stuff. So this is right. A little bit weird, but it was the money was just flowing in. And I knew guys that were fresh to Advantage Play just based on having been on some internet forum that talked about like credit card deals. And they latched on to these internet casino deals and they just scaled it up. So I was coming from the angle of online casino and online sports book. Now, after I made that post last week, I heard from the online poker players. And I remember right. back, I go, oh, yeah, I was doing some online poker back then. as well. And it was huge. This was the post moneymaker, as you certainly understand. And it was a fascinating time where, it wasn't so much that people were in love with poker. I think they were just in love with the fact that they could gamble online and there was some poker variants out there. Because myself, I was a sit and go specialist. And I was using software, SharkScope, and all these other softwares that were basically showing me soft games. And I would just jump in and play basic strategy. I wasn't really a poker mind. So there's that angle to it as well. It was affecting a lot of people.
And I at the time only really knew it as a poker issue when UIGEA passed, because that was the world that I was working in. But obviously, online casino had an audience at that point, and online sports books are, the early days of, again, to things I covered with boxing, that people were doing the tattoo, fake temporary tattoos on their back, advertising online sports books that I otherwise might not have heard of. I think Golden Palace was the big
Golden
one at the
Palace.
time. So you had accounts going in all these different verticals, doing different forms of what you considered an advantage play. How did it change in 2006? How many of your outs went away? Because with poker, a lot of the sites went away, but enough hung around that it wasn't until Black Friday that the floor fully dropped out. Was it like that for online casino as well?
Yeah, I still remember it taking a month or two before I had a transaction blocked, and my bank contacted me and said that they can no longer process these transactions and they're shutting down my account. And I argued back that I don't remember what I argued back. I argued back with somebody who really wasn't paid enough to argue with me about, treasury standards and things like that in relation to this bill. To this law at the time. And so then it became okay, well, you need to move money online, but the problem was now going to be moving online into your bank account from like NetTeller into your bank account. And that's where it really started to hit the fan. It just became too tough. I know a group of guys that went to Canada and they established an office in Canada and they were able to play in Canada for maybe 2 or 3 more years beyond the UIGEA. Maybe even longer than that. I forget. It kind of blends together there because at that point, I decided, okay, what's coming next for me? Where do I need to shift to continue my advantage play career without having to deal with this online stuff? But looking back at how easy that money was in that time period, I probably should have gone to Canada. I probably should have just said, okay, I'll just keep on grinding this angle in some other jurisdiction, because trying to find the next thing wasn't easy. And I switched back to regular casinos, brick and mortar casinos, and grinding out promotions and things there, and being chased by security. And it was all so much easier when you're just sitting online behind your desk doing whatever, rather than having to drive to casinos and fly to casinos.
And I won't make you share any numbers of what kind of money you were making at either point, but percentage-wise, how big a drop in, say, 2007 versus 2005 or something when you shifted from having all those online options to having to try and do it brick and mortar.
It was a thin period from when UIGEA went into place till about 2010, when I started to find some other ways to make a buck. It was a thin period, yeah. I don't remember my exact numbers, but it went from being tens of thousands per month easily to being really got to work at it, really got to put in the travel and the time to make the easy money, so to speak. And I think part of it that was just so deflating was the suddenness of it all. Because if you talked to, I remember I was talking to Anthony Curtis around, weeks before this all went into effect, all went down. And he said, I've talked to guys that I know in DC. It's got no chance. It's got absolutely no chance. And it, as a standalone bill, it had no chance. It was only when it was inserted into page, 738 of the Safe Ports Act that it sailed through. And I remember it was also very late at night that it passed. Like it was, it was maybe 2:30 in the morning, East Coast time. And so it was all sudden. And I remember talking to someone who had a website that basically tracked online progressives. So, all the different online casinos, they had slot progressives, video poker progressives, and he had a site that tracked them and then told you when they turned positive because they were turning positive. And, very useful site to anyone who wanted to grind out that edge. And he's like the next day, he's like, well, there goes $500,000 because nobody needs my site anymore. No one's going to track these progressives. This was an easy $500,000 a year for my company and it's gone. And it was just like that. It just erased a lot of value in the industry when it came to the third-party tools and resources that were out there.
And it's interesting you mentioning Anthony Curtis because I have a direct overlap with him right in that time period as well. He had the unfortunate timing of earlier in 2006 buying into a large stake in All In magazine, the poker magazine that I was the editor of. And it was really thriving until the moment UIGEA hit, and then half the advertisers went away. Yeah, I think his attitude was shared by a lot of people that they weren't concerned about it until the moment it passed. And then even when it passed, I remember those next few months was a lot of experts, lawyers, et cetera, weighing in saying, eh, this isn't going to be enforceable, or we'll get poker exempted as a skill game. And a lot of people remained optimistic for a while. In the end, all pessimism would have been rewarded.
You just reminded me that also my other connection with Anthony Curtis is we had invested in the Ultimate Blackjack Tour, which was a televised tournament blackjack. It was actually televised on CBS. The plan was it would have an online component and people would play online and, of course, for real money. And now this, of course, blocked that. And it actually. It ended up kind of being absorbed into Club WPT over the years, and that's where it ended up. But that was a little sizable investment for me at the time that basically just went to zero.
All right. So you laid out in your tweet four analyses of some of the longer term impacts of what UIGEA did. So I want to just go through them each one by one. You said it created a practical use case for crypto. I'm pretty sure I'd never heard of crypto at the time. Did it start to come into use soon after UIGEA, or was this more of a further down the road effect?
Yeah, it was further down the road, but that was the first time I ever, years later when I'm trying to use some offshore casinos and sports books, that's when I said, okay, what is this Bitcoin thing? What do I have to do? How do I do this? It was all very foreign to me, but I realized at the time, like, oh, okay, this is the new net teller. This is the way we move money. Now, I didn't really like it. I kind of every time I would get a Bitcoin, I would make sure that I was selling it off to somebody to figure out it. I just didn't want to hold Bitcoin. Stupid of me, but that's what it was back then for me.
And so it's not so much that Bitcoin never would have happened without UIGEA. It's just it created a as you said, practical use case, a good example of a way that people could use it because their other options were suddenly limited.
Absolutely, yes.
So the second one, and I think this is the most commonly cited industry impact of UIGEA. You said it spawned DFS via a loophole, which spawned DraftKings, FanDuel, as well as DFS 2.0 sites. What lessons could or should legislators maybe learn from this? That is there sort of a takeaway of every time you try to ban something, someone will come up with a workaround?
I think so, Eric. I mean, second order consequence for everything these days is huge. And I think we're at the point where legislators can't really even fight it. They just need to accept that there's always going to be second order consequence. The ocean is always going to find its way. And you can build as many seawalls and dams and things like that, but the ocean is a powerful force and it just finds its way through. And that's what we see with gambling a lot of times. And I think we're still seeing the ripple effects of this loophole that was in there, because first they put in a loophole for horse racing because, hey, horse racing, you know, we gotta prop that up some more. And they put in a loophole for skill-based games, and daily fantasy kind of operated under that fantasy sports loophole in there. And I, you know, like that skill-based games loophole is still to be exploited, to still to be, you know, we're finding new ways to kind of have that be a carve-out that allows for banking transactions for internet gaming. So, yeah, I rather than fight it, lean into it, right? You know, what we see a lot of times with these legislators is they finally realize that what they really want is tax money. So to regulate something is far easier path than to prohibit it. And I think we'll see more of that going forward because that's really the only way to deal with stuff like this. I think that's how we're going to find a way forward with all of this prediction market stuff. To echo what Adam Robinson said on your podcast recently.
On Jeff's podcast.
Oh, that was Jeff's podcast. As a kid now,
That's
I
all
thought
right.
you were
That's all right.
referring
It
to, wait, was
happens.
that Jeff's? But he had said that, you know, look, you know, if these states were able to get a piece of the prediction market environment, they'd back off all these lawsuits. And so that's probably the way forward.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I totally forgot that was a Jeff's
That's
podcast.
all
But I
right.
guess me and
Listen,
both. You're
you
both my two
see.
dads.
Right, exactly. And you know, you've seen one gray-haired 50-something podcaster with a beard. You've seen them all, kind of, I think is so. I don't really actually know your history as it pertains to DFS play. You did mention, you know, around 2010 you started finding other ways. Where was DFS one of them? Were you a serious DFS player in the early days of that?
I mean, I've tried it all, Eric,
Okay.
and so I did play DFS for a while. I thought I was ahead of the game by realizing that you could use basically what's called the knapsack equation, which basically is like, you know, you're going on a hike and you can only bring this knapsack that holds this much, but these are the different things that would fit into the knapsack and which of these things has the most utility. There's actually an algorithm that calculates all that. And that's how people play DFS these days is okay, we have all these players. This is their power rating. This is their salary you have to play against, and which ones fit in the best. I thought I was ahead of the game by being able to use Microsoft Solver to figure that all out on my own, not realizing everybody else was doing the same thing. And then short time later, there's tools that do all the same thing. Everyone's basically playing with all the same math when it comes to DFS. So then it becomes a situation of, well, I just want to play against the bad players. And so, you know, it's called bum hunting in DFS terms.
Right.
And you try to do that, that doesn't really work all that well. And the big sites kind of, made it so that's a little bit harder so that people of similar skills play against each other. And anyway, in the end, it really wasn't worth my time. I kind of decided it was a lot of time and effort. I never had that big score. If I ever would have
Okay.
had that huge score, I think I would have been hooked on it like that. You know, if I would have won the Millionaire Maker or whatever,
Right.
I probably would have been hooked. But at the same time, I was ready to move on to other things, and I'm kind of glad I did.
So the other two things that you hit on in your tweet are things you've touched on a bit here, but one of them, it planted the seed for sweeps and peer-to-peer skill-based gaming. You know, the sweeps idea mostly started with actually Club WPT, which you mentioned, and then with social casinos. And I remember thinking at the time that those things had no chance of catching on, the idea of gambling for little to no money. I didn't understand the appeal. Did you see any of the successes of social casino and club-based gaming coming?
No, I'm with you. Now this was your podcast. You had mentioned you had one of the founders of Prize Picks on very early on,
Right.
and Adam Wexel
Wexler, yeah.
Wexler.
Wow, you're going way. That was an early podcast. You're a true devotee.
And I felt the same way about Prize Picks when I first heard about it. I'm like, no, this is kind of dumb. This isn't going to work out. You know, this people won't want to play parlays because they're going to lose too frequently. And the payout odds were pretty egregious, in my opinion. So all in all, I was kind of sour on that. I was sour on social casinos. I think There is a point for social casinos that is a good marketing draw for people. Anytime you go out to Vegas, I go to the loyalty club at any MGM property, and there's people in line redeeming their MyVegas points. And MyVegas is like a social casino where you can earn points that earn like a free buffet. But you have to go to the Players Club booth to redeem it. These are very popular. This is something that I think, and this is where I thought it was all going. I thought people would play in the social casino to earn points for something non-monetary, that, a prize. And it kind of morphed into what it became with the sweepstakes loophole. I felt I was late getting in on that. It was still very advantageous to me, though, to participate in the sweepstakes casinos until New Jersey banned them this year. It was easy money. It was one of those things, a lot like those early days in 2000, 2001, when every operator was just giving money away every single day. And so that was a nice little wave in the past year or two.
So do you at this point have some degree of sort of an optimism that every time one option goes away, that some other easy money opportunity w is coming around the corner, that someone will think of something, or is it hard to sort of maintain that level of optimism?
I've been doing this for about 25, 20, I don't know how many years it's been. 1998 was when I kind of first got into it. And it's never not been the case, Eric. It's always been every time one door closes, another one opens, or every time a door is closed in your face, you can come in through the window. Or there's just so many different ways that the ocean finds its way when it comes to gambling and advantage play. There's always advantages out there. There's always market inefficiencies to be found. And, in the past month, I've probably found a dozen new things that didn't exist before, some with prediction markets, some with some of the markets around prediction markets, some with which way things are expanding and who's getting involved. And as long as you're willing to keep that hunger and that desire to always be trying to find what comes next? There is always something new out there.
All right, and so the last thing that you said in your tweet, quote, "Even with a carve out, it couldn't save horse racing," and then you did touch on the horse racing aspect. Big picture, if the intent of UIGEA was to do a favor to Bill Frist's backers in the brick and mortar casino industry and the horse racing industry, the old school forms of gambling, who viewed who were threatened by online. I guess it didn't really accomplish what it set out to do, or would you say it maybe they bought themselves some time with UIGEA?
I don't know it really accomplished. I mean, there was a lot of suspicion at the time that Harrah's Corporation, which became Caesars, had given a lot of money to Bill Frist, but they had given money to every politician, in especially because they were pursuing some licenses around the South there. And we see that a lot with brick and mortar tends to want to be defensive of their honeypot, right? And we saw that with sports betting. The AGA was famously against sports betting because it would stop people from going to casinos because they would be just betting on sports. We found that sports betting is actually a gateway for people to do more gambling and online casinos. And the casino industry has never been stronger. The AGA actually just put out those numbers saying that they're year-over-year growth, represented in August or September, I forget which month they put out, was their biggest growth ever. And we're going to continue to see that. That's, to keep using the same phrase, the ocean finds its way, and gambling is going to find its way. And so whether that be online or in person or whatever the next form is, it's going to be there. And I think we have a big responsibility to control it as best we can, but prohibition has never been the best way to control something, as we've seen in this country for decades and centuries.
All right. Quickly onto a few other topics, not directly UIGEA related. I'm curious, percentage-wise, roughly, how much of your sports betting action these days is on prediction markets versus on regulated sports books?
It's growing every day.
Okay.
It's definitely increasing every day because there's just a lot there. Now, we're actually at a stall point here because of the government shutdown. Polymarket hasn't been able to
Right.
self-certify, and so there and neither has Kalshi self-certify new markets. So there's a lot of things that they have ready to roll out that they haven't been able to. So if you think we're moving at a breakneck pace now, wait till the shutdown's over.
Right.
But and we're getting too big to fail. You know, we now see the NHL signing deals with
Right.
the, you know, look, you're not going to be able to put this back in the box for those of you who think we're just going to be able to, you know, turn it all off. It's getting to a point where this is a new industry in the United States, and you're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I think if there was any remaining question about that, I think DraftKings and FanDuel both fully partnering up with or buying their own prediction markets, even though they're not going to offer sports initially. Obviously, as soon as they feel comfortable doing that, they will. And I mean, is it a major threat, do you think, to just traditional online sports betting that that eventually prediction market kind of replaces it? Or I guess we've always been headed toward a situation where likely only a handful of major companies survive in the online sportsbook wars anyway. So maybe it's still just headed in that direction and they're all diversified across sportsbooks and prediction markets.
Well, I think what it comes down to, Eric, is what will the market maker scene look like? Okay, so we know that these prediction markets will be offering parlays. They will be offering same game parlays through the RFQ process in order to find market makers that are willing to put up lines. If those market makers start to compete against each other, you now have kind of a war of attrition in terms of margin. And you know, you read the quarterly statements of FanDuel and DraftKings. All they like to beat their chest about is how much they're holding on same game parlays. Their overall hold is decent, 9 to 11%, but it's propped up by the SGPs. If these prediction markets start to compete on margin for same game parlays, and if they can offer a product that appeals to the public somehow more than DraftKings and FanDuel do, that becomes a serious kind of flaw in how the whole mechanism will work. And if DraftKings and FanDuel and the like have to compete in an area where they've already held these fat margins, that spells trouble. You know, that drives that hold rate down. And that makes sports betting less attractive as a vertical within Flutter and DraftKings and their organizations. And I think ultimately it drives them out of those industries, out of those industry verticals, and just focus on online casino where everything's so much easier for them, rather than have to compete.
If they're allowed to do it in more than seven states, that is, that has just leveled off so much. But I think you're right that if online casino ever expands significantly from where it is now, then you're saying DraftKings and FanDuel and the like really become primarily online casino businesses and don't worry so much about sports betting, DFS, et cetera.
Right. And we know we're still feeling a crunch of there's less federal funds flowing to the states. States are looking to increase tax revenue. They've been holding back, but you know that anytime they want to hold a hearing on this, you're going to have a whole lot of lobbyists that come in and go, if you really want the big money, if you really want the big tax money, let us do iCasino. And they're 100% correct, unfortunately, because I think that the country's just not ready for the bankruptcy in their pocket that would result from online casino being proliferated around the country.
All right, I'm gonna wrap up with a couple of questions here, where I'm gonna ask you to set an over under line on just a couple of topics for me.
All right.
I forget, are you a 76ers fan? Or you are? Okay, that's what
I
I
mean, I have to admit that, but yeah,
thought.
geographically, that would be the
Right,
team I
if
would.
there's a team you'll root for, okay. So, over under games Joel Embiid is gonna play this season. Where are you putting the line?
I will say 24 and a half.
Oh,
That's
wow.
aggressive. I know that's aggressive, but
Aggressively low, you're saying.
Well, I mean, he played what, 19 last year?
Right. But he looked healthy in the one preseason game, and but you're just expecting at some point the knee breaks down again, is where that line's coming from.
Or he just wants to be traded. I think he's had enough of the circus that is Philadelphia sports.
Oh, that would be. I don't know who's going to trade and take on that contract, I guess, unless he's looking very healthy. But okay. Well, I'm taking the over on that,
Okay.
if you're setting the line that low. But now the most important over under the date Jeff Edelstein is back co-hosting this podcast.
Oh man, I hope it's soon.
I'm
No, he,
insulted.
no, I, no, he's, you guys just riff off of each other so well. That's,
Well, consider this your tryout to become my new riffing partner,
I don't know if I have time for podcast hosting, and
Okay, that's
I'm too
fair.
opinionated. I'm too opinionated to host a podcast.
Right.
I will set that date as 1 year from today. So 1 year from today, late October 2026, the dynamic bearded duo will be back together.
All right. Dynamic is probably strong. No one's ever called us that before, but the rest of it, bearded duo, I can definitely endorse. All right. It has been a pleasure having you on the podcast once again, Jack. I will point people toward unabated.com. They can follow you on Twitter/X at CapJack2000, your YouTube channel at Captain Jack Andrews. What's new at Unabated? I guess the NBA season is underway. Is that taking a lot of focus at the moment, or I guess NFL still always rules?
Yeah, no, and actually, let me point out that I have not put out anything new on YouTube on the Captain Jack Andrews channel in a while. However,
Okay.
on the Unabated channel,
Okay.
I have a new video every week. And these
Okay.
are some really quality videos explaining a lot of essential concepts. Like 2 weeks ago, I had prediction markets.
Right.
Understanding prediction markets, if you just kind of like, what's going on with that? Another one coming out about using risk-free bets this week. Anytime a sports book offers you a risk-free bet, how does that actually work, and what's the best way to do it and handle it? So, yes. And in terms of Unabated, on our site, the NBA just started. People are all excited about that. We have our NBA projection team, which keeps track of news, information, and injuries, as well as creates player prop projections that people can use to beat the market. So that just launched again for this season. So it's an exciting time over at Unabated.
All right, outstanding. Thanks for coming on Low Rollers, Jack. The first guest, the first two-time guest. I'm just going to lock it in that you're probably going to be the first three-time guest. I look forward to that day. But for now, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you, Eric. Always a pleasure.
Okay, my thanks again to Jack. I looked it up. Stacey Keenan played the daughter on My Two Dads. I still don't know if I'm Paul Reiser or Greg Evigan. I kind of think I'm Paul Reiser and Jeff is Greg Evigan in terms of podcast personality types, but either way, Jack, you are Stacey Keenan. One other quick note on that interview. Jack and I recorded Wednesday prior to the 76ers season opener, in which they beat the Celtics and their young guards looked fantastic, but also in which Joel Embiid looked horrendous in the 20 minutes he played. Certainly rust has something to do with it, but I'm about 5% less confident in my over on the line Jack set of 24 and a half games than I was at the time we recorded that conversation. So, moving on, final topic to discuss here on the pod this week, a big holiday coming up on Monday, the sports equinox. That, of course, is the day when there are NFL, MLB, NBA, and NHL games all on the same day. And I'm sure the online sports books will have some sports equinox specials. So let's have some fun. Let's build the official Low Rollers Equinox Parlay right now. And the books don't have lines up for any of these games yet, except the Monday night NFL game. So, we'll figure out the numbers later. Also, got to note, this is not really any kind of sound, smart betting advice. I am sure it will be a significant minus EV play, but for entertainment purposes only. In the Chiefs Commanders game, let's take the over on Rashee Rice receptions, over 6.5, which is plus money for now. It'll be game three of the World Series. Should be a nice warm night at Dodger Stadium. We know nothing at this point about what the score in the series will be. Someone could be up 2-0, could be 1-1, but ignoring all that, Freddie Freeman has been quiet this postseason, and it feels like that just can't last. So let's do a Freddie Freeman homer. NBA, lots of games to choose from. I'm focusing in on Nets at Rockets. Nets on the end of a road back-to-back. It'll be their third game in 4 days. Rockets will have had 2 days off. I'm sure the line will favor the Rockets by a lot. I don't care. Rockets to cover, whatever the line is. NHL, I don't know crap about the NHL these days, but only two games to choose from. My daughter is in college in Pittsburgh. The Penguins are home against the Blues, so Penguins on the puck line. Why the hell not? So there's your official Low Rollers Sports Equinox parlay. I will place it Monday and find out what the final price is. Everyone else, you know, join in on the fun. Put a dollar on it. Let's celebrate the Sports Equinox in style, in true Low Rollers fashion, at small stakes and based on wildly uninformed sports takes, which is almost the show's sign-off catchphrase, but not quite, so here's the right one. Until next week, this has been Low Rollers, small stakes, and hot takes.